gone. And Bonnie, too. Her bedroom window overlooked the garden, and now and then, usually when she was having a bad spell, Mr. Helm had seen her stand long hours gazing into the garden, as though what she saw bewitched her. "When I was a girl," she had once told a friend, "I was terribly sure trees and flowers were the same as birds or people, that they thought things and talked among themselves, and we could hear them if we really tried. It was just a matter of emptying your head of all other sounds, being very quiet and listening very hard. Sometimes I still believe that. But one can never get quiet enough." Remembering Bonnie at the window, Mr. Helm looked up as though he expected to see her, a ghost behind the glass. If he had, it could not have amazed him more than what he did, in fact, discern. A hand holding back a curtain, and eyes. But, as he subsequently described it, the sun was hitting that side of the house. It made the window glass waver, shimmeringly twisted what hung beyond it, and by the time Mr. Helm had shielded his eyes, then looked again, the curtains had swung closed. The window was vacant. "My eyes aren't too good, and I wondered if they had played me a trick," he recalled. "But I was pretty darn certain that they hadn't. And I was pretty darn certain it wasn't any spook, because I don't believe in spooks. So who could it be, sneaking around in there, where nobody's got a right to go except the law? And how did they get in, with everything locked up like the radio was advertising tornadoes? That's what I wondered. But I wasn't expecting to find out. Not by myself. I dropped what I was doing and cut across the fields to Holcomb. Soon as I got there, I phoned Sheriff Robinson, explained that there was somebody prowling around inside the Clutter House. Well, they came raring right on out. State troopers, the sheriff and his bunch, the KBI fellas, Al Dewey. Just as they were stringing themselves around the place, sort of getting ready for action, the front door opened. Out walked a person who no one present had ever seen before. A man in his middle 30s, dull-eyed, wild-haired, and wearing a hip holster stocked with a .38 caliber pistol. I guess all of us there had the identical idea. This was him, the one who came and killed them, Mr. Helm continued. He didn't make a move. Stood quiet, kind of blinking. They took the gun away and started asking questions. The man's name was Adrian, Jonathan Daniel Adrian. He was on his way to New Mexico and at present had no fixed address. For what purpose had he broken into the Clutter House, and how, incidentally, had he managed it? He showed them how. He had lifted a lid off a water well and crawled through a pipe tunnel that led into the basement. As for why, he had read about the case and was curious. Just wanted to see what the place looked like. And then, according to Mr. Helm's memory of the episode, somebody asked him was he a hitchhiker, hitchhiking his way to New Mexico. No, he said, he was driving his own car, and it was parked down the lane a piece. So everybody went to look at the car. When they found what was inside it, one of the men, maybe it was Al Dewey, said to him, told this Jonathan Daniel Adrian, "Well, mister, seems like we've got something to discuss." Because inside the car, what they'd found was a 12-gauge shotgun and a hunting knife. A room in a hotel in Mexico City. In the room was an ugly modern bureau with a lavender-tinted mirror, and tucked into a corner of the mirror was a printed warning from the management. Su día termina a las 2 p.m. Your day ends at 2 p.m. Guests, in other words, must vacate the room by the stated hour or expect to be charged another day's rent, a luxury that the present occupants were not contemplating. They wondered only whether they could settle the sum already owed. For everything had evolved as Perry had prophesied. Dick had sold the car, and 3 days later the money, slightly less than $200, had largely vanished. On the fourth day, Dick had gone out hunting honest work, and that night he had announced to Perry, "Nuts! You know what they pay? What the wages are? For an expert mechanic? $2 a day. Mexico. Honey, I've had it. We got to make it out of here. Back to the States. No, now I'm not going to listen. Diamonds. Buried treasure. Wake up, little boy. There ain't no caskets of gold. No sunken ship. And even if there was, hell, you can't even swim." And the next day, having borrowed money from the richer of his two fiancées, the banker's widow, Dick bought bus tickets that would take them, via San Diego, as far as Barstow, California. "After that," he said, "we walk." Of course, Perry could have struck out on his own, stayed in Mexico, let Dick go where he damn well wanted. Why not? Hadn't he always been a loner, and without any real friends? Except the gray-haired, gray-eyed, and brilliant Willie J. But he was afraid to leave Dick. Merely to consider it made him feel sort of sick, as though he were trying to make up his mind to jump off a train going 99 miles an hour. The basis of his fear, or so he himself seemed to believe, was a newly grown superstitious certainty that whatever had to happen won't happen, as long as he and Dick stick together. Then, too, the severity of Dick's wake-up speech, the belligerence with which he'd proclaimed his theretofore concealed opinion of Perry's dreams and hopes, all this, perversity being what it is, appealed to Perry, hurt and shocked him, but charmed him, almost revived his former faith in the tough, the totally masculine, the pragmatic, the decisive Dick he'd once allowed to boss him. And so, since a sunrise hour on a chilly Mexico City morning in early December, Perry had been prowling about the unheated hotel room, assembling and packing his possessions. Stealthily, lest he waken the two sleeping shapes lying on one of the room's twin beds. Dick and the younger of his betrothed's, Inez. There was one belonging of his that need no longer concern him. On their last night in Acapulco, a thief had stolen the Gibson guitar, absconded with it from a waterfront cafe where he, Otto, Dick, and the cowboy had been bidding one another a highly alcoholic goodbye. And Perry was bitter about it. He felt, he later said, real mean and low, explaining, "You have a guitar long enough, like I had that one. Wax and shine it. Fit your voice to it. Treat it like it was a girl you really had some use for. Well, it gets to be kind of holy." But while the purloined guitar presented no ownership problem, his remaining property did. As he and Dick would now be traveling by foot or thumb, they clearly could not carry with them more than a few shirts and socks. The rest of their clothing would have to be shipped. And indeed, Perry had already filled the cardboard carton, putting into it, along with some bits of unlaundered laundry, 2 pairs of boots, 1 pair with soles that left a cat's paw print, the other pair with diamond pattern soles, and addressed it to himself, care of General Delivery, Las Vegas, Nevada. But the big question and source of heartache was what to do with his much-loved memorabilia. The 2 huge boxes heavy with books and maps, yellowing letters, song lyrics, poems, and unusual souvenirs, suspenders and a belt fabricated from the skins of Nevada rattlers he himself had slain, an erotic netsuke bought in Kyoto, a petrified dwarf tree also from Japan, the foot of an Alaskan bear. Probably the best solution, at least the best Perry could devise, was to leave the stuff with Jesus. The Jesus he had in mind tended bar in a cafe across the street from the hotel, and was, Perry thought, muy simpático, definitely someone he could trust to return the boxes on demand. He intended to send for them as soon as he had a fixed address. Still, there were some things too precious to chance losing, so while the lovers drowsed and time dawdled on toward 2 p.m., Perry looked through old letters, photographs, clippings, and selected from them those mementos he meant to take with him. Among them was a badly typed composition entitled A History of My Boy's Life. The author of this manuscript was Perry's father, who, in an effort to help his son obtain a parole from Kansas State Penitentiary, had written it the previous December and mailed it to the Kansas State Parole Board. It was a document that Perry had read at least 100 times, never with indifference. Childhood. Be glad to tell you, as I see it, both good and bad. Yes, Perry Berth was normal. Healthy? Yes. Yes, I was able to care for him properly until my wife turned out to be a disgraceful drunkard when my children were at school age. Happy disposition? Yes and no. Very serious. If mistreated, he never forgets. I also keep my promises and make him do so. My wife was different. We lived in the country. We are all truly outdoor people. I taught my children the golden rule. Live and let live, and in many cases my children would tell on each other when doing wrong, and the guilty one would always admit and come forward, willing for a spanking, and promise to be good, and always done their work quickly and willing so they could be free to play. Always washed themselves first thing in the morning, dress in clean clothes. I was very strict about that. And wrongdoings to others. And if wrong was done to them by other kids, I made them quit playing with them. Our children were no trouble to us as long as we were together. It all started when my wife wanted to go to the city and live a wild life, and ran away to do so. I let her go and said goodbye as she took the car and left me behind. This was during Depression. My children all cried at the top of their voices. She only cussed them, saying they would run away to come to me later. She got mad and then said she would turn the children to hate me, which she did, all but Perry. For the love of my children, after several months, I went to find them, located them in San Francisco, my wife not knowing. I tried to see them in school. My wife had given orders to the teacher not to let me see them. However, I managed to see them while playing in the schoolyard and was surprised when they told me, "Mama told us not to talk to you." All but Perry. He was different. He put his arms around me and wanted to run away with me right then. I told him no. But right after school was out, he ran away to my lawyer's office, Mr. Renzo Turco. I took my boy back to his mother and left the city. Perry later told me. His mother told him to find a new home. While my children were with her, they ran around as they pleased. I understand Perry got into trouble. I wanted her to ask for divorce, which she did after about a year or so. Her drinking and stepping out, living with a young man. I contested the divorce and was granted full custody of the children. I took Perry to my home to live with me. The other children were put in homes, as I could not manage to take them all in my home, and them being part Indian blood, and welfare took care of them as I requested. This was during Depression time. I was working on WPA, very small wages. I owned some property and small home at the time. Perry and I lived together peacefully. My heart was hurt, as I still loved my other children also. So I took to roaming to forget it all. I made a living for us both. I sold my property and we lived in a house car. Perry went to school often as possible. He didn't like school very well. He learns quick and never got into trouble with the other kids. Only when the bully kid picked on him. He was short and stocky, a new kid in school. They tried to mistreat him. They found him willing to fight for his rights. That was the way I raised my kids. I always told them, don't start a fight, If you do, I'll give you a beating when I find out. But if the other kids start a fight, do your best. One time a kid twice his age at school ran up and hit him. To his surprise, Perry got him down and gave him a good beating. I had given him some advice in wrestling, as I once used to box and wrestle. The lady principal of the school and all the kids watched this fight. The lady principal loved the big kid. To see him get whipped by my little boy Perry was more than she could take. After that, Perry was king of the kids at school. If any big kid tried to mistreat a small one, Perry would settle that right now. Even the big bully was afraid of Perry now and had to be good. But that hurt the lady principal, so she came to me complaining about Perry fighting in school. I told her I knew all about it and that I didn't intend to let my boy get beat up by kids twice his size. I also asked her why she let that bully kid beat up on other kids. I told her that Perry had a right to defend himself. Perry never started the trouble, and that I would take a hand in this affair myself. I told her my son was well liked by all the neighbors and their kids. I also told her I was going to take Perry out of her school real soon, move away to another state, which I did. Perry is no angel. He has done wrong many times, same as so many other kids. Right is right, and wrong is wrong. I don't stick up for his wrongdoings. He must pay the hard way when he does wrong. Law is boss, he knows that by now. Youth. Perry joined the Merchant Marines in Second War. I went to Alaska. He came later and joined me there. I trapped furs, and Perry worked with the Alaska Road Commission the first winter. Then he got work on the railroad for a short while. He couldn't get the work he liked to do. Yes, he gave me money now and then when he had it. He also sent me $30 a month while in Korea War, while he was there from beginning until the end and was discharged in Seattle Wash. Honorable, as far as I know. He is mechanically inclined. Bulldozers, drag lines, shovels, heavy-duty trucks of all type is his desire. For the experience he has had, he is real good. Somewhat reckless and speed-crazy with motorcycles and light cars. But since he has had a good taste of what speed will do, and his both legs broke and hip injury, he now has slowed down on that, I'm sure. Recreation. Interests. Yes, he had several girlfriends. Soon as he found a girl to mistreat him or trifle, he would quit her. He never was married, as far as I know. My troubles with his mother made him afraid of marriage somewhat. I'm a sober man, and as far as I know, Perry is also a person that don't like drunks. Perry is like myself a great deal. He likes company of decent type. Outdoors people. He, like myself, likes to be by himself. Also, he likes best to work for himself, as I do. I'm a jack of all trades, so to speak, master of few, and so is Perry. I showed him how to make a living working for himself as a fur trapper, prospector, carpenter, woodsman, horses, etc. I know how to cook, and so does he. Not a professional cook, just plain cooking for himself. Bake bread, etc. Hunt and fish. Trap, do most anything else. As I said before, Perry likes to be his own boss, and if he is given a chance to work at a job he likes, tell him how you want it done, then leave him alone. He will take great pride in doing his work. If he sees the boss appreciates his work, he will go out of his way for him. But don't get tough with him. Tell him in a pleasant way how you want to have it done. He is very touchy. His feeling is very easily hurt, and so are mine. I have quit several jobs, and so has Perry on account of bully bosses. Perry does not have much schooling, I don't either. I only had second reader. But don't let that make you think we are not sharp. I'm a self-taught man, and so is Perry. A white-collar job is not for Perry or me. But outdoors jobs we can master, and if we can't, show him or me how it's done, and in just a couple of days we can master a job or machine. Books are out. Actual experience we both catch on right now if we like to work at it. First of all, we must like the job. But now he's a cripple and almost middle-aged man. Perry knows he is not wanted now by contractors. Cripples can't get jobs on heavy equipment unless you are well known to the contractor. He is beginning to realize that. He is beginning to think of a more easier way of supporting himself in line with my life. I'm sure I'm correct. I also think speed is no longer his desire. I notice all that now in his letters to me. He says, "Be careful, Dad. Don't drive if you feel sleepy. Better stop and rest by the roadside." These are the same words I used to tell him. Now he is telling me. He's learned a lesson. As I see it, Perry has learned a lesson he will never forget. Freedom means everything to him. You will never get him behind bars again. I'm quite sure I'm right. I notice a big change in the way he talks. He deeply regrets his mistake, he told me. I also know he feels ashamed to meet people he knows. He will not tell them he was behind bars. He asked me not to mention where he is to his friends. When he wrote and told me he was behind bars, I told him let that be a lesson, that I was glad that it happened that way when it could have been worse. Someone could have shot him. I also told him to take his term behind bars with a smile. You done it yourself. You know better. I didn't raise you to steal from others, so don't complain to me how tough it is in prison. Be a good boy in prison. And he promised that he would. I hope he is a good prisoner. I'm sure no one will talk him into stealing anymore. The law is boss. He knows that. He loves his freedom. How well I know that Perry is good-hearted if you treat him right. Treat him mean and you got a buzzsaw to fight. You can trust him with any amount of money if you're his friend. He will do as you say. He won't steal a cent from a friend or anyone else. Before this happened. And I sincerely hope he will live the rest of his life a honest man. He did steal something in company with others when he was a little kid. Just ask Perry if I was a good father to him. Ask him if his mother was good to him in Frisco. Perry knows what's good for him. You got him whipped forever. He knows when he's beat. He's not a dunce. He knows life is too short, too sweet to spend behind bars ever again. Relatives. One sister, Bobo, married, and me, his father, is all that is living of Perry. Bobo and her husband are self-supporting, own their own home, and I'm able and active to take care of myself also. I sold my lodge in Alaska 2 years ago. I intend to have another small place of my own next year. I located several mineral claims and hope to get something out of them. Besides that, I have not given up prospecting. I am also asked to write a book on artistic wood carving, and the famous Trapper's Den Lodge I build in Alaska, once my homestead, known by all tourists that travel by car to Anchorage, and maybe I will. I'll share all I have with Perry. Anytime I eat, he eats. As long as I'm alive. And when I die, I've got life insurance that will be paid to him so he can start life anew when he gets free again. In case I'm not alive then. This biography always set racing a stable of emotions. Self-pity in the lead, love and hate running evenly at first, the latter ultimately pulling ahead. And most of the memories it released were unwanted, though not all. In fact, the first part of his life that Perry could remember was treasurable, a fragment composed of applause, glamour. He was perhaps 3. And he was seated with his sisters and his older brother in the grandstand at an open-air rodeo. In the ring, a lean Cherokee girl rode a wild horse, a bucking bronc, and her loosened hair whipped back and forth, flew about like a flamenco dancer's. Her name was Flo Buckskin, and she was a professional rodeo performer, a champion bronc rider. So was her husband, Tex John Smith. It was while touring the Western rodeo circuit that the handsome Indian girl and the homely, handsome Irish cowboy had met, married, and had the four children sitting in the grandstand. And Perry could remember many another rodeo spectacle. See again his father skipping about inside a circle of spinning lassos, or his mother, with silver and turquoise bangles jangling on her wrists, trick-riding at a desperado speed that thrilled her youngest child and caused crowds in towns from Texas to Oregon to stand up and clap. Until Perry was five, the team of Tex and Flo continued to work the rodeo circuit. As a way of life, it wasn't any gallon of ice cream, Perry once recalled. Six of us riding in an old truck, sleeping in it too sometimes, living off mush and Hershey Kisses and condensed milk. Hawk's brand condensed milk, it was called, which is what weakened my kidneys. The sugar content, which is why I was always wetting the bed. Yet it was not an unhappy existence, especially for a little boy proud of his parents, admiring of their showmanship and courage. A happier life, certainly, than what replaced it. For Tex and Flo, both forced by ailments to retire from their occupation, settled near Reno, Nevada. They fought, and Flo took to whiskey. And then when Perry was six, she departed for San Francisco, taking the children with her. It was exactly as the old man had written. I let her go and said goodbye as she took the car and left me behind. This was during Depression. My children all cried at the top of their voices. She only cursed them, saying they would run away to come to me later. And indeed, over the course of the next 3 years, Perry had on several occasions run off, set out to find his lost father, for he had lost his mother as well, learned to despise her. Liquor had blurred the face, swollen the figure of the once sinewy, limber Cherokee girl, had soured her soul, honed her tongue to the wickedest point, so dissolved her self-respect that generally she did not bother to ask the names of the stevedores and trolley car conductors and such persons who accepted what she offered without charge, except that she insisted they drink with her first and dance to the tunes of a wind-up Victrola. Consequently, as Perry recalled, I was always thinking about Dad, hoping he could come take me away. And I remember, like a second ago, the time I saw him again, standing in the schoolyard. It was like when the ball hits the bat really solid. DiMaggio. Only Dad wouldn't help me. Told me to be good and hugged me and went away. It was not long afterward my mother put me to stay in a Catholic orphanage. The one where the black widows were always at me. Hitting me. Because of wetting the bed. Which is one reason I have an aversion to nuns. And God. And religion. But later on I found there are people even more evil. Because after a couple of months, they tossed me out of the orphanage. And she, his mother, put me someplace worse. A children's shelter operated by the Salvation Army. They hated me too. For wetting the bed. And being half Indian. There was this one nurse. She used to call me nigger and say there wasn't any difference between niggers and Indians. Oh, Jesus, was she an evil bastard. Incarnate. What she used to do, she'd fill a tub with ice-cold water, put me in it, and hold me under it till I was blue. Nearly drowned. But she got found out, the bitch. Because I caught pneumonia. I almost conked. I was in the hospital 2 months. It was while I was so sick that Dad came back. When I got well, he took me away. For almost a year, father and son lived together in the house near Reno, and Perry went to school. I finished the third grade, Perry recalled, which was the finish. I never went back, because that summer Dad built a primitive sort of trailer, what he called a house car. It had two bunks and a little cooking galley, The stove was good. You could cook anything on it. Baked our own bread. I used to put up preserves. Pickled apples. Crab apple jelly. Anyway, for the next 6 years, we shifted around the country. Never stayed nowhere too long. When we stayed someplace too long, people would begin to look at Dad, act like he was a character, and I hated that. It hurt me. Because I loved Dad then. Even though he could be rough on me. Bossy as hell. But I loved Dad then. So I was always glad when we moved on. Moved on. To Wyoming, Idaho, Oregon, eventually Alaska. In Alaska, Tex taught his son to dream of gold, to hunt for it in the sandy beds of snow-water streams, and there too, Perry learned to use a gun, skin a bear, track wolves and deer. Christ, it was cold, Perry remembered. Dad and I slept hugged together, rolled up in blankets and bearskins. Mornings, before daylight, I'd hustle our breakfast. Biscuits and syrup, fried meat, and off we went to scratch a living. It would have been okay if only I hadn't grown up. The older I got, the less I was able to appreciate Dad. He knew everything, one way, but he didn't know anything another way. Whole sections of me Dad was ignorant of, didn't understand an iota of. Like, I could play a harmonica first time I picked one up. Guitar, too. I had this great natural musical ability, which Dad didn't recognize or care about. I liked to read, too. Improve my vocabulary. Make up songs. And I could draw. But I never got any encouragement from him or anybody else. Nights I used to lie awake, trying to control my bladder, partly, and partly because I couldn't stop thinking. Always, when it was too cold hardly to breathe, I'd think about Hawaii, about a movie I'd seen, with Dorothy L'Amour. I wanted to go there, where the sun was, and all you wore was grass and flowers. Wearing considerably more, Perry, one balmy evening in wartime 1945, found himself inside a Honolulu tattoo parlor having a snake and dagger design applied to his left forearm. He had got there by the following route: a row with his father, a hitchhike journey from Anchorage to Seattle, a visit to the recruiting offices of the Merchant Marine. "But I never would have joined if I'd known what I was going up against," Perry once said. "I never minded the work, and I liked being a sailor. Seaports and all that. But the queens on ship wouldn't leave me alone. A 16-year-old kid, and a small kid. I could handle myself, sure. But a lot of queens aren't effeminate, you know. Hell, I've known queens could toss a pool table out the window, and the piano after it. Those kind of girls, they can give you an evil time. Especially when there's a couple of them. They get together and gang up on you, and you're just a kid. It can make you practically want to kill yourself." Years later, when I went into the army, when I was stationed in Korea, the same problem came up. I had a good record in the army, good as anybody. They gave me the Bronze Star, but I never got promoted. After 4 years, and fighting through the whole goddamn Korean War, I ought at least to have made corporal. But I never did. Know why? Because the sergeant we had was tough. Because I wouldn't roll over. Jesus, I hate that stuff. I can't stand it. Though, I don't know. Some queers I've really liked. As long as they didn't try anything. The most worthwhile friend I ever had, really sensitive and intelligent, he turned out to be queer. In the interval between quitting the Merchant Marine and entering the Army, Perry had made peace with his father, who, when his son left him, drifted down to Nevada, then back to Alaska. In 1952, the year Perry completed his military service, the old man was in the midst of plans meant to end his travels forever. "Dad was in a fever," Perry recalled. "Wrote me he had bought some land on the highway outside Anchorage. Said he was going to have a hunting lodge, A place for tourists. Trapper's Den Lodge. That was to be the name. And asked me to hurry on up there and help him build it. He was sure we'd make a fortune. Well, while I was still in the Army, stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, I'd bought a motorcycle. Murdercycles, they ought to call them. And as soon as I got discharged, I headed for Alaska. Got as far as Bellingham, up there on the border. It was raining. My bike went into a skid. The skid delayed for a year the reunion with his father. Surgery and hospitalization account for 6 months of that year. The remainder he spent recuperating in the forest home, near Bellingham, of a young Indian logger and fisherman. Joe James. He and his wife befriended me. The difference in our age was only 2 or 3 years, but they took me into their home and treated me like I was one of their kids. Which was okay, because they took trouble with their kids and liked them. At the time, they had 4. The number finally went to 7. They were very good to me, Joe and his family. I was on crutches. I was pretty helpless. Just had to sit around. So to give me something to do, try to make myself useful, I started what became a sort of school. The pupils were Joe's kids, along with some of their friends, and we held classes in the parlor. I was teaching harmonica and guitar, drawing, and penmanship. Everybody always remarks what a beautiful handwriting I have. I do. And it's because once I bought a book on the subject and practiced till I could write same as in the book. Also, we used to read stories. The kids did, each one in turn, and I'd correct them as we went along. It was fun. I like kids. Little kids. And that was a nice time. But then the spring came. It hurt me to walk, but I could walk. And Dad was still waiting for me. Waiting, but not idly. By the time Perry arrived at the site of the proposed hunting lodge, his father, working alone, had finished the hardest chores, had cleared the ground, logged the necessary timber, cracked and carted wagon loads of native rock. But he didn't commence to build till I got there. We did every damn piece of it ourselves, with once in a while an Indian helper. Dad was like a maniac. It didn't matter what was happening. Snowstorms, rainstorms, winds that could split a tree. We kept right at it. The day the roof was finished, Dad danced all over it, shouting and laughing, doing a regular jig. Well, it turned out quite an exceptional place that could sleep 20 people, had a big fireplace in the dining room, and there was a cocktail lounge, the Totem Pole Cocktail Lounge, where I was to entertain the customers, singing and so forth. We opened for business end of 1953. But the expected huntsmen did not materialize, and though ordinary tourists, the few that trickled along the highway, now and again paused to photograph the beyond belief rusticity of Trapper's Den Lodge, they seldom stopped overnight. For a while we fooled ourselves, kept thinking it would catch on. Dad tried to trick up the place. Made a garden of memories, with a wishing well. Put painted signs up and down the highway. But none of it meant a nickel more. When Dad realized that, saw it wasn't any use, all we'd done was waste ourselves and all our money, he began to take it out on me. Boss me around. Be spiteful. Say I didn't do my proper share of the work. It wasn't his fault any more than it was mine. A situation like that, with no money and the grub getting low, we couldn't help but be on each other's nerves. The point came we were downright hungry, which is what we fell out over. Ostensibly, a biscuit. Dad snatched a biscuit out of my hand and said I ate too much. What a greedy, selfish bastard I was, and why didn't I get out? He didn't want me there no more. He carried on like that till I couldn't stand it. My hands got hold of his throat. My hands. But I couldn't control them. They wanted to choke him to death. Dad, though, he's slippery, a smart wrestler. He tore loose and ran to get his gun. Came back pointing it at me. He said, "Look at me, Perry. I'm the last thing living you're ever gonna see." I just stood my ground. But then he realized the gun wasn't even loaded, and he started to cry. Sat down and bawled like a kid. Then I guess I wasn't mad at him anymore. I was sorry for him. For both of us. But it wasn't a bit of use. There wasn't anything I could say. I went out for a walk. This was April, but the woods were still deep in snow. I walked till it was almost night. When I got back, the lodge was dark and all the doors were locked. And everything I owned was lying out there in the snow, where Dad had thrown it. Books, clothes, everything. I just let it lie. Except my guitar. I picked up my guitar and started on down the highway. Not a dollar in my pocket. Around midnight, a truck stopped to give me a lift. The driver asked where I was going. I told him, "Wherever you're headed, that's where I'm going." Several weeks later, after again sheltering with the James family, Perry decided on a definite destination. Worcester, Massachusetts, the hometown of an army buddy he thought might welcome him and help him find a good-paying job. Various detours prolonged the eastward journey. He washed dishes in an Omaha restaurant, pumped gas at an Oklahoma garage, worked a month on a ranch in Texas. By July of 1955, he had reached, on the trek to Worcester, a small Kansas town, Phillipsburg, and there, fate, in the form of bad company, asserted itself. His name was Smith, Perry said. Same as me. I don't even recall his first name. He was just somebody I'd picked up with somewhere, and he had a car, and he said he'd give me a ride as far as Chicago. Anyway, driving through Kansas, we came to this little Phillipsburg place and stopped to look at a map. Seems to me like it was a Sunday. Stores shut, streets quiet. My friend there, bless his heart, he looked around and made a suggestion. The suggestion was that they burglarize a nearby building, the Chandler Sales Company. Perry agreed, and they broke into the deserted premises and removed a quantity of office equipment, typewriters, adding machines. That might have been that if only, some days afterward, the thieves hadn't ignored a traffic signal in the city of St. Joseph, Missouri. The junk was still in the car. The cop that stopped us wanted to know where we got it. A little checking was done, and as they say, we were returned to Phillipsburg, Kansas, where the folks have a real cute jail, if you like jails. Within 48 hours, Perry and his companion had discovered an open window, climbed out of it, stolen a car, and driven northwest to McCook, Nebraska. Pretty soon we broke up, me and Mr. Smith. I don't know whatever became of him. We both made the FBI's wanted list. But far as I know, they never caught up with him. One wet afternoon the following November, a Greyhound bus deposited Perry in Worcester, a Massachusetts factory town of steep, up-and-down streets that even in the best of weathers seemed cheerless and hostile. I found the house where my friend was supposed to live, my army friend from Korea. But the people there said he'd left 6 months back and they had no idea where he'd gone. Too bad. Big disappointment. End of the world. All that. So I found a liquor store and bought a half gallon of red wop and went back to the bus depot and sat there drinking my wine and getting a little warmer. I was really enjoying myself till a man came along and arrested me for vagrancy. The police booked him as Bob Turner, a name he'd adopted because of being listed by the FBI. He spent 14 days in jail, was fined $10, and departed from Worcester on another wet November afternoon. I went down to New York and took a room in a hotel on 8th Avenue, Perry said, near 42nd Street. Finally, I got a night job, doing odd jobs around a penny arcade. Right there on 42nd Street, next to an automat. Which is where I ate. When I ate. In over 3 months, I practically never left the Broadway area. For one thing, I didn't have the right clothes. Just Western clothes. Jeans and boots. But there on 42nd Street, nobody cares. It all rides. Anything. My whole life, I never met so many freaks. He lived out the winter in that ugly, neon-lit neighborhood, with its air full of the scent of popcorn, simmering hot dogs, and orange drink. But then, one bright March morning on the edge of spring, as he remembered it, two FBI bastards woke me up. Arrested me at the hotel. Bang! I was extradited back to Kansas. To Phillipsburg. That same cute jail. They nailed me to the cross. Larceny. Jailbreak. Car theft. I got 5 to 10 years. In Lansing. After I'd been there a while, I wrote Dad. Let him know the news. And wrote Barbara, my sister. By now, over the years, that was all I had left me. Jimmy is suicide. Fern out the window. My mother dead. Been dead 8 years. Everybody gone but Dad and Barbara. A letter from Barbara was among the sheaf of selected matter that Perry preferred not to leave behind in the Mexico City hotel room. The letter, written in a pleasingly legible script, was dated April 28, 1958, at which time the recipient had been in prison for approximately 2 years. Dearest Brother Perry, we got your second letter today and forgive me for not writing sooner. Our weather here, as yours is turning warmer, and maybe I am getting spring fever, but I am going to try and do better. Your first letter was very disturbing, as I'm sure you must have suspected, but that was not the reason I haven't written. It's true the children do keep me busy, and it's hard to find time to sit and concentrate on a letter, as I have wanted to write you for some time. Donnie has learned to open the doors and climb on the chairs and other furniture, and he worries me constantly about falling. I have been able to let the children play in the yard now and then, but I always have to go out with them as they can hurt themselves if I don't pay attention. But nothing is forever, and I know I will be sorry when they start running the block, and I don't know where they're at. Here are some statistics if you're interested. Freddie, height, 36 and a half inches. Weight, 26 and a half pounds. Shoe size, 7 1/2 narrow. Baby, height, 37 and a half inches. Weight, 29 and a half pounds. Shoe size, 8 narrow. Donnie, height, 34 inches. Weight, 26 pounds. Shoe size, 6 1/2 wide. You can see that Donnie is a pretty big boy for 15 months, and with his 16 teeth and his sparkling personality, people just can't help loving him. He wears the same size clothes as Baby and Freddie, but the pants are too long as yet. I am going to try and make this letter a long one, so it will probably have a lot of interruptions, such as right now it's time for Donnie's bath. Baby and Freddie had theirs this a.m., as it's quite cold today, and I have had them inside. Be back soon. About my typing. First, I cannot tell a lie. I am not a typist. I use from 1 to 5 fingers, and although I can manage and do help Big Fred with his business affairs, what it takes me 1 hour to do would probably take someone with the know-how 15 minutes. Seriously, I do not have the time nor the will to learn professionally. But I think it is wonderful how you have stuck with it and become such an excellent typist. I do believe we all were very adaptable. Jimmy, Fern, you, and myself. And we had all been blessed with a basic flair for the artistic, among other things. Even Mother and Dad were artistic. I truthfully feel none of us have anyone to blame for whatever we have done with our own personal lives. It has been proven that at the age of 7, most of us have reached the age of reason, which means we do, at this age, understand and know the difference between right and wrong. Of course, Environment plays an awfully important part in our lives, such as the convent in mine, and in my case, I am grateful for that influence. In Jimmy's case, he was the strongest of us all. I remember how he worked and went to school when there was no one to tell him, and it was his own will to make something of himself. We will never know the reasons for what eventually happened, why he did what he did, but I still hurt thinking of it. It was such a waste. But we have very little control over our human weaknesses, and this applies also to Fern and the hundreds of thousands of other people, including ourselves. For we all have weaknesses. In your case, I don't know what your weakness is, but I do feel it is no shame to have a dirty face. The shame comes when you keep it dirty. In all truthfulness and with love for you, Perry, for you are my only living brother and the uncle of my children, I cannot say or feel your attitude towards our father or your imprisonment just or healthy. If you are getting your back up, better simmer down, as I realize there are none of us who take criticism cheerfully, and it is natural to feel a certain amount of resentment towards the one giving this criticism, so I am prepared for one or two things. A. Not to hear from you at all, or B, a letter telling me exactly what you think of me. I hope I'm wrong, and I sincerely hope you will give this letter a lot of thought and try to see how someone else feels. Please understand, I know I am not an authority, and I do not boast great intelligence or education, but I do believe I am a normal individual with basic reasoning powers and the will to live my life according to the laws of God and man. It is also true that I have fallen at times, as is normal. For as I said, I am human, and therefore I too have human weaknesses. But the point is, again, there is no shame having a dirty face. The shame comes when you keep it dirty. No one is more aware of my shortcomings and mistakes than myself, so I won't bore you further. Now, first and most important, Dad is not responsible for your wrongdoings or your good deeds. What you have done, whether right or wrong, is your own doing. From what I personally know, you have lived your life exactly as you pleased without regard to circumstances or persons who loved you, who might be hurt. Whether you realize it or not, your present confinement is embarrassing to me as well as Dad, not because of what you did, but the fact that you don't show me any signs of sincere regret and seem to show no respect for any laws, people, or anything. Your letter implies that the blame of all your problems is that of someone else, but never you. I do admit that you are intelligent and your vocabulary is excellent, and I do feel you can do anything you decide to do and do it well. But what exactly do you want to do, and are you willing to work and make an honest effort to attain whatever it is you choose to do? Nothing good comes easy, and I'm sure you've heard this many times, but once more won't hurt. In case you want the truth about Dad, his heart is broken because of you. He would give anything to get you out so he can have his son back, but I am afraid you would only hurt him worse if you could. He is not well and is getting older and, as the saying goes, he cannot cut the mustard as in the old days. He has been wrong at times, and he realizes this, but whatever he had and wherever he went, he shared his life and belongings with you when he wouldn't do this for anyone else. Now, I don't say you owe him undying gratitude or your life, but you do owe him respect and common decency. I personally am proud of Dad. I love him and respect him as my dad, and I am only sorry he chose to be the lone wolf with his son, or he might be living with us and share our love instead of alone in his little trailer and longing and waiting and lonesome for you, his son. I worry for him, and when I say I mean my husband too, for my husband respects our dad, because he is a man. It's true that Dad did not have a great extensive education, but in school we only learned to recognize the words and to spell. But the application of these words to real life is another thing that only life and living can give us. Dad has lived, and you show ignorance in calling him uneducated and unable to understand the scientific meaning, etc., of life's problems. A mother is still the only one who can kiss a boo-boo and make it all well. Explain that scientifically. I'm sorry to let you have it so strong, but I feel I must speak my piece. I am sorry that this must be censored by the prison authorities, and I sincerely hope this letter is not detrimental towards your eventual release, but I feel you should know and realize what terrible hurt you have done. Dad is the important one, as I am dedicated to my family, but you are the only one Dad loves. In short, his family. He knows I love him, of course, but the closeness is not there, as you know. Your confinement is nothing to be proud of, and you will have to live with it and try and live it down. And it can be done, but not with your attitude of feeling everyone is stupid and uneducated and ununderstanding. You are a human being with a free will, which puts you above the animal level. But if you live your life without feeling and compassion for your fellow man, you are as an animal. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and happiness and peace of mind is not attained by living thus. As far as responsibility goes, no one really wants it. But all of us are responsible to the community we live in and its laws. When the time comes to assume the responsibility of a home and children or business, this is the seeding of the boys from the men. For surely you can realize what a mess the world would be if everyone in it said, "I want to be an individual without responsibilities and be able to speak my mind freely and do as I alone will." We are all free to speak and do as we individually will, providing this freedom of speech and deed are not injurious to our fellow man. Think about it, Perry. You are above average in intelligence, but somehow your reasoning is off the beam. Maybe it's the strain of your confinement. Whatever it is, remember, you and only you are responsible, and it is up to you and you alone to overcome this part of your life. Hoping to hear from you soon. With love and prayers, your sister and brother-in-law, Barbara and Frederick and family. In preserving this letter and including it in his collection of particular treasures, Perry was not moved by affection. Far from it. He loathed Barbara, and just the other day he had told Dick, "The only real regret I have. I wish the hell my sister had been in that house." Dick had laughed and confessed to a similar yearning. "I keep thinking what fun if my second wife had been there. Her and all her goddamn family." No. He valued the letter merely because his prison friend, the super-intelligent Willie J, had written for him a very sensitive analysis of it, occupying two single-spaced typewritten pages, with the title, "Impressions I Garnered from the Letter," at the top. Impressions I Garnered from the Letter. 1. When she began this letter, she intended that it should be a compassionate demonstration of Christian principles. That is to say, that in return for your letter to her, which apparently annoyed her, she meant to turn the other cheek, hoping in this way to incite regret for your previous letter and to place you on the defensive in your next. However few people can successfully demonstrate a principle in common ethics when their deliberation is festered with emotionalism. Your sister substantiates this failing, for as her letter progresses, her judgment gives way to temper. Her thoughts are good, lucid, the products of intelligence, but it is not now an unbiased, impersonal intelligence. It is a mind propelled by emotional response to memory and frustration. Consequently, however wise her admonishments might be, they fail to inspire resolve, unless it would be the resolve to retaliate by hurting her in your next letter, thus commencing a cycle that can only culminate in further anger and distress. 2. It is a foolish letter, but born of human failing. Your letter to her, and this her answer to you, failed in their objectives. Your letter was an attempt to explain your outlook on life, as you are necessarily affected by it. It was destined to be misunderstood or taken too literally because your ideas are opposed to conventionalism.